Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the PPG Advocacy Task Force discussion panel for March 20th. Depending on how you look at the first day of spring, it's either today or tomorrow. So it's very spring-like here in Maine. So welcome to spring. So if two dog trainers get together, both can undoubtedly give many examples of clients who have unrealistic expectations for their pet. Today's topic is unrealistic expectations. Where do they come from and how can we diffuse them? We'll begin by discussing the source of these unrealistic expectations. And I'm going to start off with a pet peeve of mine, which I call the perfect pet in 7 days syndrome. And there are book titles basically that way, from written by people who should know better. It's all over the internet, social media, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, pick your poison, TV trainers. And to me, it's one of the most frustrating things because it ultimately immediately sets people up to fail. So let's start with that one and thoughts on how do we help diffuse that? And don't make me be picking people. Kim, thank you.
You know, as a baby trainer, when I was coming up, I had seasoned dog trainers giving me advice on marketing messaging, and that, you know, perfect puppy in 7 days sells books. It sells services. I do think that those folks that should and do know better about you can't get a perfect puppy in 7 days. It's a hook. You know, to hopefully it's a hook to get them in to read the book and get all those, you know, useful, realistic nuggets of information that we need to raise a lovely puppy. But it can set up this expectation that's not realistic. And I understand why, as an industry, we do these things. You know, Google, if I take the word obedience off my website, you know, is Google going to find me, you know, and it's part of, you know, running a business, and it unfortunately has a negative impact on the animals.
No, I mean, it does. And that's why it frustrates me so much. And you know, I will give the authors of those books some grace, because oftentimes the author does not get to pick the title of the book or the artwork that's on it. I've got someone I know who wrote a great book on pet nutrition, and it really focused on obesity. And on the first edition of his book, he was allowed to pick the cover photo. And it's this dog that is so obese, it looks like a tick. And when the second edition came out, it has a cute little, I don't remember, it's a lab or golden puppy. And the first thing I did was I wrote back to him. He said, "Why'd you change the picture?" And he said, "Wasn't my decision. It was the publisher." So yeah, sometimes they don't get to pick. Other folks, other thoughts on this? And as we're going through here today, we've got a bunch of dog folks in the room, or folks that are mostly dog folks. I know I fall in that category, and our resident cat specialist couldn't be with us today. Keep in mind, this stuff happens with cats too. So if you've got some stuff to help out with cats also, but who would like to speak to this next? Dan.
I like working with families that have kids because I can draw parallels to how long it takes to raise a child. And we're talking about a couple of decades. So I try to reframe it so they understand just how young their puppy is. I mean, we're talking about a matter of weeks, and the brain is developing, and everything in that puppy's life is new. So it seems to help people get in touch with that, so they have more realistic expectations.
I think that's a good strategy. Who else wants to speak to this?
I think I sort of take the same. I would have two sort of like thoughts about this. Number one is, if I'm working one-on-one with clients, I would definitely, like Kim, say, wow, that's, you know, if they bring this up, I'd be like, that's an awesome marketing hook. And that's probably why that trainer was using it. Like, I'm not going to throw the trainer under the bus, right? And be like, you know, they probably, you know, that's the kind of thing that appeals to us humans. And so that's how they would pull you in. And then I would probably go into one of the other comparisons that I would like to use to be like, but actually, you know, dog training is more like imagine if there was a book title, Mental Health in 7 Days, you know, like everybody would get how ridiculous that sounds, right? Now, when I think about advocacy towards the public, you know, if I'm talking about blogs that I'm going to write, or if I'm speaking more broadly, then I think it is important to keep pushing back that we can't, you know, that good training can take time. You know, it's very rare that there's going to be a solution, maybe an equipment change or something that's going to make this huge difference in a short period of time. So I would say, you know, one-on-one, I'd be sort of gentle and, you know, bring up other examples. Broadly, though, I do agree that I think this is something that we have to, as a community, push back against, that there's this magical ability that you can, you know, do one thing and all of a sudden your dog will be sort of match the perfect dog in your mind.
Well, and, you know, you brought up books, and I'm thinking, look at all of the self-help book titles, not having anything to dogs, that take even the same premise. I mean, it's not just mental health, but weight loss, you know, change your life in 7 days or even 4 weeks, which, you know, I think, yeah.
Learn a language. I've seen Learn a Language in 7 days.
Yeah. Anybody else want to talk on that? And if not, what are some other places these unrealistic expectations come from that you've seen? Oh, Dan.
This is my favorite, so I have to bring it up. I think it stems maybe from the concept of human dominance and that we're the boss and the dog is just an animal. And people that think they can give their dog something and then just take it away. I should be able to take away that bone or take away your food bowl without objection. And I like to use an analogy of going to a restaurant. So especially after COVID, you know, we finally get to go out to our favorite restaurant. We order our favorite meal. The wait staff brings it. We're getting into the food, and then they come and just take it away. Because I gave you that food. I should be able to take it away, right? It leads to a lot of confrontation, but I've seen with puppies where they became resource guarders by the time they went into adolescence because the people couldn't just take it away anymore.
That's certainly an unrealistic expectation. Unfortunately, it's one that I think our profession needs to take some responsibility for creating that many, many years ago with how we approach dealing with the food bowl. 25 years ago. And, you know, so that's certainly where some of that comes from. Christina, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the unrealistic expectations, you know, they're cultural, and some of it I think is just human nature. You know, you just, like, even professionals forget what it's like to have a puppy, right? Like, you get a puppy and you're so excited and it's going to be all sunshine and rainbows. and then there they are. And it's not all sunshine and rainbows, but some of it, I think it's just being human, right? Like we just want these good things and we have these unrealistic expectations. And I think some of it comes from struggling in the moment and wanting a fast solution, right? There's a strong motivation to seek out quick solutions because we're all limited in time and who wouldn't want that? And I think there's, you know, cultural aspects to it as well. And probably, I'm not probably, but media, right? So Lassie and all of these other movies about how dogs are supposed to behave. I mean, in some ways we've made a lot of progress in how we depict humans on screen, I think, but I haven't seen any changes in how dogs, you know, dogs are just, they just continue to be nice, well-behaved dogs, or maybe there's a joke that they're misbehaving, but it's just not being, people don't see what's happening behind the scenes. And then when it happens to them, they think that there's something wrong with their dog because it's not, they're not seeing all of these other people and dogs that are, and I say struggling, but it might just be normal, right? But people don't talk about all of that type of thing a lot. And so maybe in terms of one of the solutions, it's just talking about it. Like, you know, and I think that's something trainers can help to normalize a little bit is like, hey, my dog does this, you know, our dogs get in trouble too. Like, that's just how life is. Like, nobody's perfect.
I mean, I think those are good strategies. And I think it was in the Culture Clash where Gene Donaldson really attributed some of the views on dogs to Lassie and Rin Tin Tin. So I've been reminding students and people for years that, you know, those were marvelous pieces of heartwarming fiction, but they were fiction. And I have a whole collection of Lassie and Timmy and the Well cartoons. Cartoonists really, really get this. And there have been some new ones that have come out crazy that I will occasionally use in presentations to help get the point across too. But the other thing I want to hit on here too, I think it's sometimes people remember the last dog. And they remember the last dog when it was a senior citizen and, you know, spent most of the day sleeping. Really didn't get into stuff anymore because it's just too much work. Or they got lucky the first time and had a perfect of pick your breed or mix of breeds and then get the next one and it's gone to the opposite extreme. You guys see that as well?
Yes. Had that conversation yesterday.
Okay. I also think that kind of piggybacking a little bit on what Christina was saying about having biases, and that's one bias that you describe, you know, previous life experience. But I also think that if we look at just the nature of dog training, the history of it, the proliferation of dog training schools, I mean, If you go back in time and look at history, you know, dogs were trained to perform a job. That's all they were ever trained for hundreds of years. And then, you know, in the 20th and 21st century, we started training dogs for other things, right? How to be a pet. And our profession is really only about 40 plus years old, you know? So people, I think, come into, I going back to the parenting reference, you know, I was raised by a baby boomer. I'm a child of the 70s. You know, I was parented with some harsh methods, right? So I was taught, you know, how behavior change happens in a non-positive reinforcement way sometimes. So, you know, I might grow up as an adult thinking that my dog, you know, should behave a certain way. And this is how I'm going to teach him. And the early obedience training often taught us that that's how you do it. I'm a crossover trainer. I trained dogs on choke chains for years before I crossed over to being a force-free trainer. And it is a huge learning curve for somebody who comes from having a long history of understanding behavior one way. Right. I am the dominant one. I'm the one that controls the resources. I'm the one that goes out the front door first. The dog can't sleep in the bed. The dog's not allowed on the furniture. You know, the dog shouldn't growl at the child when the child sticks their fingers in their food bowl. You know, these are all things that I think for many of us, we were raised to believe that that's the truth, that that's the way it should be. And it's hard, I think, sometimes to have a pro come in and say, you're doing it all wrong, you know, and nobody wants to change their own behavior. And everybody loves their dog. I've never met a pet parent who didn't love their dog, even if they were being harsh to their dog. They thought they were doing it because it was the right thing to do. And I think that's why a lot of this continues on in at least in our American culture. I understand it's different in other cultures.
Well, I think you bring up, I think the baby boomer reference is a good one, because I know Dan fits in that category because he and I were in high school at the same time, actually the same high school, which is just still blows my mind. We didn't know each other back then either. But that's kind of when parenting methods changed. Because I have to say, you mentioned how you were parented, and I had surprisingly progressive parents for the era. which was kind of interesting. And I think that does play an effect too. We got something here on the chat I want to bring up, and I think this is an important thing to talk about. It's expectations not clearly communicated and agreed are premeditated resentments. And this gets into another place where I see this happening a lot, and that's where shelters and rescues and even breeders, in order to get the pet, I'm going to say purchased, because no matter where you get it, that's really what's happening, are told things that might not be entirely factual. Like, oh, the dog gets along with all other dogs or all cats, or the dog already knows how to sit and come when called. People get it home, and then they're coming to me and saying, I was told all of this, and the dog doesn't know any of this, and their whole laundry list of problems. And over the years I've been doing this, you know, I hate to say this, but I have had some clients that have said, I will never get a rescue dog again because of that bad experience. Am I alone in seeing that, or do you guys see that too? And I mean, part of it, I keep talking to shelters and rescue groups, and I say, you've got to give people realistic expectations. Every time you send them home with unrealistic expectations and they don't happen, you're potentially losing a client, a future client. What do you guys have to say about that?
I don't think it's just your experience. I'm pretty sure I won't be able to pull the reference up, but I'm pretty sure I remember Zazie Todd telling me that that's actually been studied and that's actually borne out. So people who have a bad experience behaviorally with misinformation from a shelter will not go back. And so I think that is alarming to me. And that is something that, you know, as a profession, we definitely need to start, you know, somehow pushing back against that, because that's really bad for dogs.
And I agree. I mean, I think it's unfortunate, but the fact of the matter is that probably, we don't have good data on this, but it seems highly likely that dogs in shelter environments and cats and other species are much more likely to have really sort of overwhelming stress and high levels of stress in their background. And we know that that has very severe and long-lasting impacts on behavior. And I think that there are ways to communicate that information without necessarily scaring people away. So, you know, for example, you can say something like, this dog had a really hard start in life and they're probably going to need some extra attention in these areas, which would be very different from saying, you know, this dog is probably really severely damaged because of stress, right? Like there are ways to handle it. And then I think, now, whether or not the people believe you or not is a different story, but I think it's a twofold thing when we're talking about shelter and rescue groups. And I'm saying this knowing full well that not all shelter and rescue groups have the resources to do this, right? So this is sort of aspirational and moving in this direction, but providing people with information and then follow-up resources and support so that they have a way, you know, they have help in dealing with the inevitable issues that come.
No, I think that's good advice. And that's kind of the way I place it too, that, you know, this dog just became homeless overnight. And to use Dan, I like to use analogies to humans like Dan does too. You know, imagine you and your family just ended up homeless overnight and someone does an assessment on you the next day. Are they going to get a clear idea of what you're really like? Yeah, probably not, because that's a pretty traumatic experience. And at least if people are set up that they have to go slow, and it kind of goes against this, you know, the 7-day thing we started with, and we have gotten to be such a society that is, I'm going to use the fast food industry, you know, drive up, get it now. You can get anything you want and you can get it now. And that includes a perfect pet. And I think we're fighting that on a societal level, not just with dogs and cats, with almost everything. Cute pup there behind you, Christy. So
they are barking. Livestock guardian dogs. Who would have thought?
So what are some of Dan gave us one of the unrealistic expectations, but I'm going to start off with one here that I think is a significant problem. And that's that people have this idea, and somebody, Christy, I think you alluded to rainbows, but you know, that if in a reality, dogs, if given their druthers, would all be frolicking in a meadow all day long with rainbows, and everybody would be getting along, and it would just be wonderful. And that's the way dogs naturally are. How do we deal with that one? Or am I alone in seeing some people that really think that's the way it is? Christy's grinning. I think she's with me.
It wasn't me who said rainbows, but I love that analogy.
So go ahead, Kim.
Sorry. I always use the term puppies and butterflies, you know, because everybody thinks that puppies and butterflies are these wonderful things. You know, I have an online membership that's fairly new, and you know, it has a working title and a very specific, you know, pathway we follow each week when we meet online together. But it's interesting to me that everybody who comes refers to it as a support group. And so that's, that's their takeaway.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I get feedback on is that I share about my own dog who I got as a puppy, going back to what Christina said, you know, these expectations we have, very first dog ever that I got from a breeder, because I've always rescued, you know, gone to a shelter or, you know, rescued a dog off the street. And so expectation being that, you know, I'm going to get a puppy and it's not going to have any behavior problems. And lo and behold, you know, she does have some behavior problems. And so as I'm being, you know, kind of transparent with my clients and talking to them about my own struggles with my own dog and how I work through them and what I do, it can really be a good gateway to opening up people's minds about what is reality, what is changeable, you know, what, you know, how does behavior change and how slow the process can be sometimes when we're working with things like anxiety and fear and things like that. So I think that as professionals, we have to be, and I'm sorry, I might be getting off track of what you originally were saying, but I think as professionals, transparency about whether it be, I know somebody yesterday in our advocacy group even brought up separation anxiety, about how, what it takes to actually help these pets and being upfront in our first interactions with people. I think sometimes as pros, you know, we don't want to scare people away, but I think we have to be very transparent about what it's like to work with these dogs and cats.
Dom, would you mind if I just jump in here for a minute, Dom?
Please do.
Sorry, I'm the tech person behind the scenes, but this is a fascinating conversation, so I have to chip in here. And I think what Kim said is so valid, and I think we have to be honest. I think honesty is really important. And I was going to give you a little example here. I've been working with a client for the last 6 months who has what he would describe as a reactive dog. And we've seen some great progress. But every week when he arrives, he always looks a bit glum, and I have to sort of give him a bit of a slap and say, "What's up? What's wrong? What's going on?" And within minutes, I get the smile and, you know, let's focus on the good stuff, because let's not lose touch of what's happening that's really, really good. Anyway, this particular client invited me around to his birthday party. And for those of you that know me dearly would go, "My God, you left your house?" I don't do parties. I don't go anywhere unless I absolutely have to. And I went there with my husband knowing that it was going to be an exhausting evening, because just being around more than one person I find exhausting. So on the way over there, we're already making our excuses for how we're going to get out of there early. You know, do we have a dog to get home to? Is one of us going to be ill? What are we doing? And when I got there, we walked into the house and there must have been 30 people there. Loud music playing, everyone drinking cocktails. And this dog was lying on the sofa, legs akimbo, relaxed, having a good time. And every single person that went past him stroked him and said, what a wonderful dog. And I walked over to my clan and I actually physically slapped him across his head and said, if you ever complain to me about your dog's behavior again, you will see physical violence. Because how many of us could have our dogs in that situation? In a house with 30 odd strangers, noise, cars coming and going, people going in and out. And the dog was so chilled out. And I said to him, you have no idea the gem that you have living in your home. And he sort of looked at me and he was really surprised. And when he came to see me the week after, he said to me, my wife overheard you. And after you left, she actually slapped me and said, don't you ever dare moan about our dog again. Because, and I think sometimes we're not honest. And I don't think we're honest with ourselves. And I don't think we're honest with our clans. And I don't think in general, as humans, we're honest about these wonderful creatures we have living in our homes. And the fact that they're going to irritate us sometimes, aren't they? I mean, I love my husband to death, but he irritates me every day. I mean, people that we share our lives with do irritate us. So I just think sometimes we have to be honest about the fact that we have to look for the really good stuff as well and not just focus in on the bad stuff.
I mean, I think that's a key point. I mean, I've always, you know, I wouldn't have been in this profession unless my wife and I had got this first Cairn Terrier puppy together, who was a medical disaster, a behavioral disaster, a nutritional disaster. And he's what got us all learning about dogs and deciding we wanted to do more. I mean, Gus literally changed our life and we loved him to death, but there were days we also just, you know, man, why did we ever sign on for this? And if you share with people and explain how you got through those tough times, I think it does help them out. And our other Cairn Terrier, who was a rescue, and this one I use a lot with people who have a dog that doesn't get along well with other dogs and think the dog is doomed to a life of misery. And I explained to them that, you know, Dulcie lived with four other dogs while she was, well, they gradually died off until it was just her and Ticken. But I said, she got along fine with us and she had a perfectly wonderful life, but she never once solicited an interaction or to play with the other dog. She was also the smallest dog in the house and had no problem telling them, back off, Bozo. And everybody just said, we understand, just do your thing. She had a perfectly wonderful life. And I think people don't realize that that can happen as well.
You know, dogs are social animals and so are we. And that's what I always explain to my clients. And I, you know, the human analogies that you've mentioned time and time again today, I use dating and personal relationships. And I just say, you know, none of us marry the first person we go on a date with. A few of us maybe have, but right. Most of us, you know, we have to, you know, pick the one that's best for us. And especially I think when it comes to friendships, especially as we get older, you know, as humans, you know, we don't have a huge circle of friends. We're not friends with everybody we meet. You know, we don't go to the mall to go shopping and walk up to everybody and give them a hug. Hi, my name is Kim. Will you be my friend? Like, we just don't do things like that. And neither
is that not considered socially acceptable?
No, Nikki, it's not. Okay. Stop doing it.
And that's why some of us avoid places like the mall, right? Try to see somebody like that and go running the other direction. You know, I do much the same thing. You know, we have this scale of personalities within humans. Some of them are the extreme extrovert and some of them are the extreme introvert. Well, why should we be shocked and surprised if we see the same thing within dogs, especially since some of those dogs have been bred to be kind of suspicious of any other living thing?
And Don, that's a really interesting, and I want to bounce back to something Kim said earlier, so I'm going to come back to that. But I think that's a really interesting comment, because if you look at people that know me through PPG as an example, I'm going to use myself because I obviously know myself intimately well. Most people would say, oh, Nikki's quite confident, she's gregarious, she's outgoing, she's very social, and would probably label me as being an extrovert. But actually, the people that know me really well know that I do a really good job of acting like an extrovert when I have to. But I'm actually, by all definitions, a real introvert. And there have to be dogs that are like that as well, right? That that can figure out when they're forced into a daycare situation or into a dog park, that they sort of can, if they have to for survival, come across as being fairly okay, but given the choice, wouldn't choose to be there. And I think they're the dogs that we have to look after and sort of, you know, advocate for, because they're the dogs that tend to get pushed into bad situations. But I want to just jump back to something Kim said earlier, because I found this fascinating, Kim, and you were talking about your membership group. So you've created this product and program with an expectation that you're providing an online membership, but everybody who bought and paid into that, or most people, are going into that with the assumption and the belief that it's actually a support system. And I think that goes to show where this word expectation gets us in trouble, because you have two parties coming to that table who both have completely different expectations and beliefs and assumptions about what they're involved in. And obviously in your situation, knowing you as I know you, I'm sure you manage it extremely professionally and do a bloody good job at it. But that's where we can get into trouble, isn't it? Because both parties coming to that juncture have different assumptions and expectations and beliefs about what they're experiencing. And I find that absolutely fascinating that customers are going, oh, this is great support. Isn't that interesting that that's what they are getting from it, more so than a membership?
Right.
I find that's fascinating.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
I think this is really important, and we're starting to get more research on this topic, but there have been a few papers printed, and they're really the things that people are reporting in these papers is really heart-wrenching in terms of what they're talking about. So there is a paper published by Kristen Buller and Kelly Ballantyne in 2020. And they interviewed a number of people that were living with animals with behavior issues. And they talk about how much people are struggling and how they feel overwhelmed. So like, here's a quote, it says, "I get tense, I worry about it, I feel overwhelmed if I think it will always be like this. It makes me extremely sad to see my dog suffering. Aside from the fact that it burdens me, it is even more of a burden to him because he cannot help his anxiety." And then someone else talks about how no one outside of the family got to appreciate how amazing she really was. And these are really, you know, and they also talk about the lack of support that they feel from friends and family, because people say things like, just get rid of the dog, or, you know, why are you dealing with this? Or why don't you just lock the dog in the room and let us come over? And it's, you know, I think that the negative expectations impact the dogs negatively, obviously, and again, other species too. And they're also impacting the people very negatively as well.
Well, and I think it's why by the time they get to us, often there is, I mean, how often do you feel that high level of resentment? Clients are angry with their dogs, right? They're angry because they brought this dog into their life with an expectation of the butterflies and puppies. And they suddenly find themselves having to manage where they go and when they go and how they go and who they can have in the house and what you can do in the house. And, you know, can I have to sneak out? Because if the dog sees me, it might get anxious. I mean, these are life altering scenarios for people. And that unfulfilled expectation leads to resentment, doesn't it? And for those of us that love animals and have a lot of empathy and compassion, we don't tend to feel resentful. We tend to get down and depressed. But people that don't have that level of empathy probably start to get very, very angry towards the animal, which, you know, God knows what that leads on to, right? When somebody feels trapped in their own home.
Well, and that can go another way too. And I had this one situation where I had a couple and they started communicating with me separately, which is when I knew I had to tell them they needed some human help, because one did not feel safe going in their own home because of the dog. You know, and I'm sure I see some heads nodding. I'm sure other people have had that go too. And, you know, that's a really, really frightening thing. How do you handle that?
I guess you could leave your spouse. Take the dog with you.
You know, Dawn, I have
I have two cases right now. You know, this whole conversation, you know, that what Christina just brought up is hitting home for me a lot. One, because I am one of those pet parents who's struggling with their own dog, and being a dog pro, it's super frustrating to have people try to give me unsolicited advice. I'm like, I've had two veterinary behaviorists. I have a CSAT I'm working with. I'm a dog pro. I've got my general practice vet. I mean, I've got support. Thank you very much. But it can be overwhelming, but it has given me a greater sense of empathy for my clients than I could have ever had before having this experience with my own dog. And I thought I already had a lot of empathy. And I realized how much more I need to have. But right now I have two clients, and a friend. So technically three conversations I've had this week about rehoming and behavioral euthanasia. And in all three of these situations, one, you know, the dog is growling and finally bit the disabled spouse in the home who's 88 years old. The other one, the dog is so sound phobic that if the dog hears a sound and gets scared, it launches at the 68-year-old owner and starts biting her. And the third one, my friend, who suffers from his own mental health issues, the dog is desperately afraid of him. And he's had this dog for a year and has tried to work through it, and it's affecting his own mental health. So, you know, I've had to counsel these folks, you know, as a dog trainer, you know, not a human therapist, about addressing everybody's needs, their needs, the dog's needs, their family members' needs, and providing resources for them, because I can't be that resource for all the things. You know, I have to wear my dog pro hat appropriately, but acknowledge that everybody's feelings and everybody's experience is important. And there is nothing more important than feeling safe in your own home. You have to feel safe in your own home. And if you don't, something needs to be done today. You know, whether that be a management strategy or some other decision that needs to be made. But, you know, we walk a fine line when we're dealing with these very sensitive issues. And I think it's important that every dog pro have a list of resources quick and ready that you can give to clients so that they can get support elsewhere, that the dog trainer is not the only place they're getting support from.
Well, and sometimes the issue you have to look at, this is something I had to do very early in my career, probably 4 months into my career. We rescued a dog who the dog and I bonded like that, probably the closest bond I had with a dog, also ended up being the biggest dog in the house. And the first month was fine and dandy. And after that first month, she decided one of our other dogs would be better off no longer amongst the living. Fortunately, I was able to intervene in time. And I had a place, I had a kennel where I could put her until I figured out what I was going to do. And I talked to lots and lots of people, and they helped me realize, you know, even if you can fix this, how are your other dogs going to feel with her living in the house while you're working on that? Wow, yeah, that's a really good point. And as much as I wanted to fix it, I knew I needed to rehome her. I was fortunate I was able to rehome her with the previous owner, whose circumstances that resulted in having to rehome her to begin with ended up, and she lived the rest of her life quite content there because there weren't other dogs around. But yeah, it's not fair for humans in the home or other animals in the home to be fearing for their life. We need to talk about cats. Some people will say cats are easy. And I have to admit, the cats I've had, in most cases, they have been incredibly easy compared to dogs. But I have helped some clients with cats that were anything but. What are unrealistic expectations people have about cats? And how can we help them and help diffuse those unrealistic expectations.
So I'm not a cat behaviorist, but I think with cats, in some ways, it almost goes the other direction, where there's this expectation that cats are just going to be grumpy, mean, scared, sort of awful animals. And then when they are like that, people are like, well, that's just how cats are, right? And people don't think about the fact, well, maybe that's a welfare issue, right? Like they don't have to. So it's almost like the bar for cats is so low that I think a lot of people really dismiss their needs. And so in some ways, I almost think it's like dogs are up here and we need to bring it down, and cats are down here and we need to bring our I don't mean the expectations for the animal. Well, I guess I do kind of, right? Like we can hope for and work towards having cats that aren't always scared and scratching and biting. And I'm not saying at all that cats aren't that cats are all like that. But I mean, you just go look up cat memes, right? Like there's so much of that they're just sort of selfish little terrors.
You know, I think you hit the nail on the head. About 20 years ago, the state of Maine had I was appointed to the State Animal Welfare Advisory Council. And one of the things we formed was a task force on cats, because they were basically, compared to dogs, were second-class citizens. That's the way we described it. And we looked at a number of issues. And then, unfortunately, there wasn't enough wherewithal to do something about it. But I think that what you stated there is really part of the issue. So how do we change that? Because I mean, cats can be wonderful. And until we rescued our first cat, I became a cat person during that process, and really wasn't until he was gone and no longer hanging around me deep at night while I was in the office, the only person still sticking around me, that I realized how attached I got to him. But how do we change that?
Something that just came up this week for me is a friend was talking about her cat. And the thing that I think I hear about, and maybe it's because I live kind of rurally, is just the scratching thing, like how people, you know, there's this, oh, I can't believe the cat's scratching. You know, there's not an idea that cats have to scratch and that it's important for their bodies and their welfare. And, you know, and I know, thank goodness, that the surgery to remove their lower digit is becoming banned in a lot of places, which is awesome. But I think it sort of points to that bigger issue that Christina was talking about, is people don't expect us to meet cats' needs, you know, like the cats should just be slinking off in a corner, catching mice or something. So, yeah.
They're lucky we feed them. Let's just leave it at that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wish Zazie was here, because she does such a great job with really raising the bar about what we could expect from cats. And she does it, I think, like in such great ways. Like, it's not just cats need enrichment. She's like, here's some plants that are safe for cats that cats adore, and here's how to do it, you know, and here's what you should see.
We've got a panel scheduled in the coming months where we're going to focus specifically on cats. So maybe we can do some of that there. But when you talked about scratching, it brings to mind another thing, and this applies to dogs as well. Cats have a lot of natural behaviors they need to do to be happy. So do dogs. And a lot of those behaviors are ones that we have issues with. So how can we do a better job of educating people about that, you know, hey, your dog barks, deal with it. Kim, you raised your hand.
Yeah, one of the things that I've always appreciated about PPG is the multi-species education. And you go to a PPG conference and there's a cat track. And I understand that, you know, all these dog conferences, right? There's a lot of dog trainers and much, much fewer cat trainers or cat behaviorists out there. But even recently, the Legs conference had a presentation on cats. I think it's really important that for those that specialize in cats, if they can be brave enough to start presenting at these conferences more, whether they're online or in person, if every conference could have at least one cat presentation, because so many of us dog trainers are going into homes where there's cats. I saw a Facebook post about a month ago where a dog trainer went to into a home, a carefully planned out first time visit with a dog who had issues with visitors in the home. And she goes in and all of a sudden she hears, "Row," and the cat launches off the couch and attacks her and bites her. And the owners say, "Oh, you know, he does that, you know, no big deal." Like they didn't think to mention it, you know, because we tolerate things from cats that we wouldn't tolerate from a dog. But even in the screening process, like that trainer, like, could she have been asking questions in her intake form and all of that about the other pets in the home? Like, I think—
Do you have a kamikaze cat in the home?
Right. You know, just educating those of us that don't specialize in that species about what to look for, questions to ask, you know, minimal point of entry on how we might support the family with that. And then having resources, again, that we can refer people to saying, "I'm not a cat expert." Like I have one in Phoenix, Carrie Schwartz. I refer to her all the time when people have issues with cats because they don't get their needs met the same way that dogs do.
And Kim, isn't it exactly the same with pet care providers, pet sitters, and boarding facilities? Cats tend to be the sort of ugly stepsister, but I owned a boarding kennel and animal hospital for years, and cats actually scared me more than dogs because A, they can be awfully difficult to handle, and B, if they do not eat, it can be a medical emergency within 24 hours. It's not like a dog where you can just give it hot dogs for a couple of days until it gets comfortable.
Yeah.
From the same level of experience, I mean, one of the rules around here is, you know, if you get bitten by a cat, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. You are going to the ER immediately because it's much more likely to end up with a serious infection. And, you know, with dogs, we don't worry about it as much. I mean, but that's part of it. But I think the other place it gets important for people like us is how many times do we go into a home where there is not only a dog, but there is a cat, maybe more than one. And sometimes we have to deal with how do we get everybody to just all get along?
Especially with management, right? Because management is really important. And you're going to give very different management advice if you're going into a multi-species home than if you're going in just with one or two dogs.
Well, I'm glad you brought up management because
you're welcome.
One of the unrealistic expectations I see is people don't want to deal with management, even though, in my opinion, it's the easiest way to solve some of these problems. They want an elaborate training solution. Yeah. How do you help clients understand, you know, there's an easy way to management that's probably going to work? No, we've got to train this dog to do that. Or let's talk about that, because that's one I see a lot, too.
When I go into clients that have got significant behavior problems that you know are going to be a long-time investment, whether it's financially or time, whatever, I always say this, you've got two options. There's a management option, there's a behavior modification option. And I think when you spell those out honestly, a lot of clients just go, well, do the management's going to work for us? For a lot of people, I think Suzanne Clothier does a really good webinar on this, that sometimes management's enough, right, if you get it right?
Oh, definitely.
And for a lot of pet owners, they're fine with that. And how many times do we walk around a client's home? And I always reminds me of Vicky Stillwell when she used to do it to me over dog, where she'd go around the home and sort of look at the home and how it was set up. But we actually do that, don't we? We do find ourselves walking into people's bedrooms and talking about furniture positions and dog gates and windows and drapes and all that kind of stuff. So I think, again, we have to be honest, and I think importantly, we have to always explain the why. We can't just ask someone to do something without, especially with adults, without explaining the in order to. And anyone that's been in the military gets that, right? You don't ever just give a command to someone in the military. You say in order to, so that if for some reason their goal is interfered with, they still know how to do the mission because they know what they're trying to achieve. So I think a lot of it with adults is explaining what they need to do and why they need to do it. And if that why connects back to the goal that's been agreed on for the behavior program, you've got a lot more chance of them buying into it because it resonates with them. It's important. They can see the significance.
I always explain it that management is just the first point of entry into solving the problem, because especially if you're dealing with something like aggression, you have to have management in place in order to even have the behavior change plan. And I really like to use analogies, human analogies, and I use the education analogy. You know, grade school, management. You know, beginning parts of training, high school. Like, and we're working up to like college degree, graduate degree, PhD level type behavior, depending on what we're talking about. And you don't get into high school without graduating eighth grade. So you can't get into the beginnings of your behavior change problem if we're not managing this situation so that the rehearsal of the behavior can't happen. The wonderful thing about management is that you're going to discover that you're going to see a huge reduction in this problem behavior. And you might find that you're perfectly happy to continue to implement the management. And you can take breaks from training, right? This daunting task of having to train the dog all the time because the management's working. And so when I explain it to them like that, they buy in. And then if they don't buy into the management, then I tell them that it's highly likely that the behavior change plan is going to be very, very slow because your dog's going to be able to practice this behavior.
So I've got a good example of where that worked for a client. This was many, many years ago. And it was a separation anxiety dog. And if left alone, it would totally trash the house. So we talked about the importance of really managing, tried to encourage them to talk to a vet behaviorist about pharmaceuticals. And they didn't want to do that. I want to hit on pharmaceuticals before we're done here today, too. And what they finally found was, and this worked, because first of all, here we're in Maine, and they had a heated garage. You'll find why that's relevant in a moment. They could leave the dog in the car, in the heated garage, while they went grocery shopping, and life was fine. And that's all they had to do. And when they found that solution, which they found on their own, they didn't find it through me. They said, you know, I think we're good here. They lost motivation to resolve it beyond that. So sometimes management can solve the problem. But let's talk about pharmaceuticals. And this popped up in my mind, Christina, when you were talking about that study. And, you know, there are a lot of dogs that have some serious issues. And I mean, one of the things I have learned over the years is sometimes those pharmaceuticals can really, really make a difference. And I'm fortunate, I don't know, been pre-COVID 5-6 years now, we've had a veterinary behaviorist in Maine that I've had someone I could refer to. But even still, and this is a conversation she and I have had, is, you know, lots of people just don't want to, oh, there's no way I want a pharmaceutical solution, you know, that's just unreasonable to do that with a pet. What do you guys see and think about that? And recognizing none of us are veterinarians, but we can refer to people that can do that. What are your thoughts?
Don?
Yeah.
About 60% of the dogs I work with, due to the severity of the behaviors, are work being seen by veterinary behaviorists. And probably a good 50% of the time, it's hard, you know, when you first say something about pharmaceuticals, people are very, and it's like a script. I don't want my dog to be a zombie, you know, and it's always that word. I don't want my dog to be a zombie. The unfortunate thing is within the general practitioner veterinarian community, when they've been asked, and especially a lot of the older vets, when they've been asked about pharmaceuticals, they're like, you know what, we'll just sedate them, you know, let's give them alprazolam, you know, various other things, and we'll just sedate them. And then people are like, you know, my dog just lays around, he's lethargic, he won't eat, you know, that's not the kind of dog I want. So the unfortunate thing is that lack of education of what we're really doing here is lacking. Now, because of a more robust focus on mental health for people, we can also use those analogies to help people understand that their dog is having a mental health crisis as well. And, you know, as we would do for people, as we would do for a child, whatever, you know, doing the same for our pups where warranted is going to create a dog who lives a better life, has a better quality of life. And so if we approach it that way, where we're talking about quality of life, not just for the dog, but for the people, for the entire household of dogs and people, or dogs and cats and people, whatever it may be, that's usually when I get buy-in. And I've had one recently that took a few months, and the wife was finally able to convince the husband to go with it. And having just seen them a week ago, sending me pictures of their dog paddleboarding with their husband amongst a group of paddleboarders, and the dog just laying on the paddleboard, just hip kicked out to the side, tongue hanging out of its mouth, you know, just so relaxed.
Love it.
Right. But it's, and I know for me, one of the things that I've been lucky enough is I have a number of clients who volunteer to talk to other clients that I may have who are reluctant to say, I was too, but, you know, because we did, this is what happened. So having clients that can step forward to do that for you, educating them that, you know, this is not a zombie dog, letting them know that it's not us that's doing this. These are veterinary behaviorists. And you said Maine, I'm assuming Dr. Calder?
Yes.
Yeah. Who I've worked with telephonically, as well as the veterinary behaviors. And not everybody has a vet behavior, so I understand that. And there are some younger vets I'm seeing in my area who are becoming more and more involved in learning about, you know, small animal behavior, and are starting to attend seminars and conferences where that's being brought up. But again, it's just like everything else. It's all the expectations always comes back to education, right? And so we can be in the forefront of that. We can use our own experiences. In my case, now this is my third dog in a row who, because of the severity of the issues, he's on the medications. Does it make him the perfect dog? No, because there is no such thing as the perfect dog. Let's face it, right? But it gives him such a good quality of life. And you know, there's a lot of trainers out there who don't believe in pharmaceuticals, who don't believe that we should ever be, you know, the veterinary behaviorists aren't needed, that nutraceuticals or, you know, the eponymous CBD will fix everything type of stuff. So without the education, though, we're not going to make any strides. Our job is to educate.
I really like, there's two resources that I give to people if there are trainers that are watching today that need resources. And the first one is Behavior Vets has a two-part free webinar called The Dose of Hope. So you can send that to clients and they can, you know, watch it online for free. And then there's a really great blog post by the training company called Canine of Mine. I can't think of the trainer's name right now. But if you just Google Canine of Mine behavior medications, this trainer's done a really nice job of listing out all the different medications, the different types of things that they're used for, and also explaining very clearly and in a good way that, you know, we're not veterinarians as dog trainers. You know, we cannot tell a client that their dog should be on medication. But what I do is I tell the client that I think that it would be a worthwhile discussion to have with their general practice veterinarian or to consult with the veterinary behaviorist whether or not medications would support the behavior training plan for the dog. And then I do share, I have my own dog on medication. I've had past dogs on medications. And like Sam, I've had countless client dogs on medications. And they have had a profound impact on successful outcomes. They're very, very helpful.
And I have had some where management and medications and problem solved. And the dog is having such a much improved life. Yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Jen's dog blog also has a good introduction for clients who are considering medications. It's called something like medications are not the last resort or something.
Right.
And before we end, because I know we're getting close, and it occurred to me halfway through. So I want to share this thing that the Academy is doing right now, and it relates to educating. Well, like Sam was saying, how educating is really what we need to be doing the most of here. So a lot of times, and I think people who are used to training with aversives, so they might have that like rose-colored spectacles last dog thing because they trained with aversives with their last dog and their last dog was kind of behaviorally shut down. Or they're just used to how quick of a fix it feels when you shut your dog down with something that's really terrifying. They're not used to sort of the time that it might take to train a dog using positive reinforcement in an operant conditioning context, or even if they're using desensitization and counter conditioning, those things just take time, right? So the Academy recently, we started this campaign. It's like for the entirety of March, it's called it's like a hashtag 30 days of practice. We sort of stole it from musicians because there's a musician who I really like who does this 100 days of practice campaign every year. And she just shows herself playing the violin just for like 30 seconds. So instead of getting like this beautiful, oh my God, mind-blowing piece that you're watching at the orchestra, you see her practicing and failing, you know, a lot, like just doing little pieces. So we decide we're gonna do this for dogs. And so we're just putting out like one video a day or a couple videos a day of what actual operant conditioning looks like, how there's repetition, how there's great mechanics, how there's, sometimes dogs fail a trial, you know, like, so we're really trying to educate dog training, like the meat of dog training, which is building behaviors, you know, or building a CER takes repetition and time and good practice. So that sort of, I realized at the beginning, I should have led with that because it's an educational piece, but it's also like really opening the doors to, and I think a lot of people, like even some of our close colleagues, like vet behaviorists or people who study like ethics of animals, they don't know necessarily what training looks like the grunt work that we do to get these beautiful behaviors at the end, so.
Well, Christy, I think that's a great way to wrap us up. And I think that might be a great topic for us to do in general sometimes, because in generally, I think most people don't get the whole number of repetitions that goes into training a dog to get them where you want. And it goes back to that kind of what we started with, best dog in 7 days. Well, you know, okay, I asked them to sit 10 times on Monday and, you know, now they should have it mastered. And so great way to wrap things up. Very good discussion today, everyone. I thank you for being here and participating. And those of you listening, thank you for listening. And thank you for those tips on resources. Pam, I don't know if you can do this, but if you can maybe find some of those, and when we post this, put them in with the post, I think that would be good. The ones we had here at the end on medications and stuff might be useful if we can actually post the links. So we will see you next month. And what's happening next month? Oh, so we are doing a new type of panel, and it's not a full panel. We're trying some different things, mixing it up a little bit. And this is a series that's going to be called Conversations About Compassionate Care and Connection. And it's going to be a couple of folks from the advocacy division talking about with someone. And next month, our guest is Laura Donaldson. And we're doing a similar session. I should have put it in my notes. I think it's in September, where we'll be talking to Dr. Carolina Westland. But that's it for today. And we will hopefully see all of you here again next month. Thanks.
Right.